This is a recording for the Oral History Project of brief answers to a list of specific questions about my experiences as a student and later as professor and chairman of the Department of Physiology. My full name is William Barton Humans. I was born in Mount Healthy, Ohio, a suburb of Cincinnati, on February the 3rd, 1910. Now, on July the 13th, 1990, I am in my 80th year. For a number of years, my biography appeared in American Men of Science and in Who's Who in America. However, for about 10 years now, I have been a non-person as far as these publications are concerned. I have filed with the Department of Physiology and the Archives a short biography including a description of my research accomplishments as I see them, and a list of my publications. I received the BS degree from Western Kentucky State College with a major in biology and minor in chemistry in 1932. From 1932 to 1935, I was instructor in biology there. As a student at Western, I had courses in biology taught by Dr. H.L. Stevens, who had a PhD in plant physiology and plant pathology from the University of Wisconsin. And I had a course in biochemistry taught by Dr. J.T. Skinner, who had a PhD in agricultural biochemistry from the University of Wisconsin. The head of the biology department was Dr. M.C. Ford, who had a PhD in soils from the University of Wisconsin. These individuals influenced me to apply for admission to the University of Wisconsin Graduate School. I also explored the possibility of going to Vanderbilt University, went there for an interview with Professor Walter Gary, head of the physiology department. He was at retirement age at that time, and when I mentioned Wisconsin as one of the schools I was interested in, he became quite enthusiastic about both Wisconsin and Dr. Meek. I applied for a Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation scholarship for the academic year 1935-36. Dr. Stevens and Dr. Skinner wrote the letters of recommendation that convinced Dr. Meek that he should accept me. The stipend for the scholarship was to be $400. But shortly I received another letter from Dr. Meek, which indicated that he would appoint me to a research assistantship at $600. I have always wondered how I happened to get a 50% raise before I arrived on the scene. Very shortly after my wife Cynthia and I arrived in Madison, the Meeks took us on a picnic to Devil's Lake. I soon learned that becoming a graduate student under Dr. Meek was a bit like becoming a member of his family. In the first conference with Dr. Meek about my course schedule, he stated that I should take all of the basic medical science courses as a part of the PhD program in physiology. Early in my second year, Meek advised me to enroll as both graduate and medical student, and at the end of the third year, including summers, I had completed requirements for the PhD in physiology in the first 2 years of medical school. As of the spring of 1938, a position for an instructor in physiology became available at the University of Oregon Medical School under Dr. Hans F. Haney, who had received a PhD in physiology at Wisconsin a few years earlier. I was offered and accepted this job for 1 year. My plan was to return to Wisconsin after 1 year and take the courses of the third and fourth years of medical school. However, I was offered a permanent position in Oregon and I accepted. This decision involved giving up the plan of finishing the medical school work. But during the Second World War in 1942-44, I resumed studies and completed requirements for the MD at the University of Oregon Medical School. I shall now go back to questions about my year as a research assistant under Dr. Meek, that is 1935-36, my full first year at Wisconsin. It turned out that I worked as a research assistant directly with Dr. Meek for only about 2 to 3 months. When I arrived in September of 35, he had just acquired a new electrocardiograph. He planned to spend 2 afternoons per week studying effects of anesthetic agents and substances such as epinephrine and its congeners on heart rate and rhythm in dogs. My tasks were to bring the dogs from the animal quarters down to the basement lab in SMI to assist with the anesthetization, to attach electrodes, to operate the electrocardiograph. In other experiments, we took x-rays of heart size in dogs which were at various levels of chloroform anesthesia. Dr. Meek was not able to devote as much time to research as he had planned, so I also assisted Dr. Raymond Heron with some studies of effects of adrenal cortical extract on blood volume and hematocrit. Previously, Heron and Meek had prepared some dogs with segments of the small intestine in the form of fistulas. Some of these had been denervated. I suggested I make use of these animals to determine if the denervated segments were sensitized to the chemical mediators produced by the nerves which had been sectioned. They agreed, and I performed these studies and also studied several reflexes elicited from distension of the innervated intestinal segments. These were studies which I could perform alone. I also assisted Dr. Meek with studies of effect of insulin on gastric motility, which had been started by Dr. Joseph Lelich. The first 8 papers of my bibliography were derived from studies done during my 3 years as a graduate student at Wisconsin. The next 2 papers in the list were initiated at Wisconsin and completed at the University of Oregon Medical School. The Department of Physiology at the University of Wisconsin in the mid-1930s was a small department which was doing a huge amount of teaching. Except in the medical physiology course, the laboratory instruction was done mainly by teaching assistants. Dr. Meek lectured in a large undergraduate course and taught the neurophysiology part of the medical physiology course. As a classroom teacher, he was a role model. His lectures, while covering the essential facts of the topic, also were presented in an interesting manner and aroused one's desire to learn more about the subject. The 2 best lectures that I had as teachers at the University of Wisconsin were Dr. Meek and Dr. C.H. Bunting, who was chairman of pathology. Bunting's lectures were so systematic and complete with regard to essential facts as to make a textbook unnecessary if you took adequate notes. He appeared to make no use of notes. Meek's reputation as a researcher rests largely on his studies of origin and conduction of the cardiac impulse. And prior to the studies of effects of anesthetic agents, this work was done in close collaboration with Eister. For further comments on the work of Meek, Eister, Erlanger, and Gasser, I refer you to my paper in The Physiologist, May 1975. The Department of Physiology granted 38 Ph.D. degrees during the period from 1923 to 1952, the year that I returned as chairman. Dr. Meek was major professor for most of these. As my article in The Physiologist summarizes, all of his Ph.D. students achieved outstanding positions as teachers, researchers, or administrators. In most cases, all 3. I attribute Meek's success as a major professor to, first, his selection of students, second, his requirement of a broad background in the medical sciences for candidates for the Ph.D. in physiology, and third, his skill in directing and criticizing research, and fourth, his valuable suggestions about the final writing of the paper for publication. I learned how to prepare dogs with various types of intestinal fistulas by working as a surgical assistant with Dr. Meek and Dr. Heron. They used morphine premedication and ether anesthesia. George Pierstoff, who was hired as a general handyman in the laboratory, served as the anesthetist. When I began to do the operations myself, he made it very clear that serving as anesthetist was not one of the tasks that he enjoyed. After listening to his grumblings through several operations, I told him one day that as of that moment I was retiring him from his job as anesthetist. I did not like the smell of ether any more than he did, and thereafter I used barbiturates which could be given intravenously. The chief laboratory helper, referred to by the German term of Diener, was Clarence Rowley. He was responsible for keeping all of the laboratory equipment in good working condition, and he did this very conscientiously and effectively. This equipment was mainly for the teaching laboratories. It was apparent that Clarence did not like the idea of letting research assistants borrow this equipment, although he always reluctantly turned it over to me when I asked for it, and he was always delighted to get it back. He was most happy when instruments were clean and polished and sitting on the shelves. In other words, he understood his role and performed it quite well. In the period that I was a graduate student, a medical student at Wisconsin, I had the following instructors: Bast and Geist in histology and neuroanatomy, Bradley and Witzman in physiological chemistry, Meek, Eister, and Heron in physiology, Mortensen, Mossman, and Sullivan in gross anatomy, Bunning in pathology, Tating and Severs in pharmacology, Clark and Holford in bacteriology. Phil Cohen was my laboratory instructor in physiological chemistry. It was particularly useful to me as an irregular student to be allowed to work in gross anatomy according to my own schedule. I did this throughout one Christmas vacation period. There was effective and conscientious coverage of subject matter in all of the courses. Unfortunately, many of these courses at present are attenuated. Josephine Maurer was secretary of the Department of Physiology and for the assistant dean's office, since Dr. Meek also held this office. Dr. Middleton had just become dean in 1935. Admissions of students to medical school were handled by Middleton and Meek. Meek served as pre-medical advisor also and spent the first few days of each semester approving the programs of pre-medical students. I will now describe the handling of papers for publication. When I thought a research project was completed, I would write the paper for publication, submit it to Dr. Meek. He would put it in his desk and I would hear nothing, usually for 2 or 3 weeks. In the meantime, I may have done some additional experiments or even decided to make a few changes. Finally, I would be scheduled on short notice to meet with Dr. Meek to go over the paper. He usually would have written in a few suggestions or have noted a few sentences that he felt could be improved, and I would then rewrite the paper and return it to him. It was then given to Jo Maurer to be typed, and usually she would do this within a few days. I would go over the paper for any final corrections, and then it would be submitted, in most cases, to the American Journal of Physiology. All except 2 of the first 8 papers of my bibliography, which is on file, were handled in this way. No paper that I submitted for publication during my period as a graduate student was rejected. It may be noted that Meek is not listed as one of the authors in 3 of the 8 papers, which shows that he did not sign in as a co-author on every paper appearing from his laboratory, although he legitimately could have done so in these cases, since I used some of the dogs with fistulas that had been prepared by him. My work as a research assistant was made possible in part by Mr. Hipple in the machine shop, because some of the studies required the use of a constant injection machine. Mr. Hipple promptly designed a suitable machine which I used at Wisconsin and I had another one built by Ed Martin in Portland when I moved to Oregon. I was appointed as research assistant only for 1935-36. I was appointed as instructor in 36-37 and 37-38 while working as a graduate student. For a number of years now, this has not been permitted at the University of Wisconsin. My salary as instructor was 2.5 times. This concludes the report about my period as a student at the University of Wisconsin. I received a PhD degree in the spring of 1938 and shortly moved to the University of Oregon Medical School with the expectation of returning to the University of Wisconsin for the 1939-40 academic year. My salary as instructor at the University of Oregon Medical School in 1938-39 was double that which I had received in the previous year at the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Hans Haney was acting head of the department. At the end of the year, he was appointed head of the department and offered me a permanent position, which I accepted. My research at Oregon went well, and I obtained financing for all of it from the John and Mary R. Markle Foundation. Then I went on part-time basis in 1942-44 and completed requirements for the MD degree. I interned at Henry Ford Hospital in 1944-45. Shortly after I returned to Oregon from Detroit, Dr. Haney became professor of medicine and I was appointed head of the Department of Physiology. I continued to receive support for research from the Markle Foundation. However, one day John Russell, their director, came by and explained that they were going to establish a Markle Scholars Program. He was interested in suggestions on how to select scholars. I advised him to let each medical school choose its own candidate. This idea was new to him. It became the method which he finally adopted. The next step, which I think he devised, was to have the candidates meet together with interviewers for several days. My research support from the Markle Foundation evaporated when they initiated the Markle Scholars Program. However, the golden period for supported research by National Institutes of Health was then beginning. In the fall of 1951, I received letters from Dr. Eister and Dean Middleton raising the question about my returning to the University of Wisconsin as chairman of the Department of Physiology. As of February 1952, after much correspondence and a trip to Madison, arrangements for my appointment had been completed. In returning to Wisconsin, I had the advantage of knowing exactly what to expect, and in fact, I encountered very few surprises during my tenure from 1952 to 1976. I knew that physiology had the responsibility of teaching more undergraduate student credit hours than all of the other medical school departments combined. This continued to be true throughout my tenure. I have a summary of teaching loads from 1967 to 72, which shows that in 1967 to 68, there were 11 basic science departments, a total of 5,200 undergraduate student credit hours was taught. Physiology taught 3,012 of these. In 1971-72, 5 years later, the total was 9,411, of which physiology taught 5,251. Also during the period from 1967 to 72, which included the last 4 years of my tenure as chairman, the Department of Physiology taught more graduate student credit hours than any other basic science department. In 1971-72, the number was 615 for physiology, with oncology next with 468, and 373 for physiological chemistry. In 1971-72, there were 124 freshman medical students. These numbers will serve to explain why the physiology department sometimes was referred to as a teaching department. It is worth noting that medical students during the period when they were required to take national board examinations ranked at least in the upper 15 in scores in physiology among the medical schools of the United States, and one year they ranked third. A comparison for a 10-year period in view of the consistently high rank in physiology would probably give our rating in the top five schools. However, our teaching was never directed toward preparing students for national boards, and I never personally approved of requiring students to take the national board examinations. I felt that this should be left to their own discretion. During the period from 1923 to 1951, 39 PhDs were granted by the Department of Physiology. From 1952 to 1971, 53 PhDs were granted. Most of this group are members of the American Physiological Society. Many are professors. Some have been departmental chairmen. Some are directors of research laboratories. All were able to obtain jobs immediately on graduation or went on to finish medical school. A few are deceased and several are retired. The Department of Physiology can provide a list of these graduates for anyone who has need of it. The graduate school also can provide the list. I served as major professor for 24 of the PhD candidates from 1952 to 1971. In a few cases, jointly with George Rowe and Charles Crumpton in the Department of Medicine. All of these became active physiologists, and several of them have been or are very active in research. This includes Larry Davis, Kenneth Getz, John Krasny, Jane Hart, Warren C., Daniel Savage, John Foltz, and Delmont Smith. Four have been or are departmental chairmen. These are Charles Tidball, Delmont Smith, Larry Davis, and Robert Schopp. I have filed with the Archives and the Department of Physiology a document that summarizes my education, memberships in professional societies and fraternities, awards, editorial positions, membership on state and national institutes of health committees, research accomplishments, and a list of publications through 1975. I refer the listener to this summary for all such information. A few facts are noteworthy. I was a member of NIH committees for 12 consecutive years, and each of these required 3 trips per year to Washington. These meetings were concerned with approving grants and aid of research or for fellowships or training grants. I was a member of the research committee of the Wisconsin Heart Association for 6 years and chairman of it during the last 2 years. The funding of research in the Department of Physiology came mainly from grants and aid of research or training grants from National Institutes of Health, grants to individual professors from Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, and grants for support of specific projects by Wisconsin Heart Association. Fortunately, throughout my period as chairman, funding for research was not difficult to obtain. Following this, the purse strings began to tighten. At this point, I refer the listener to an article in Wisconsin Medical Alumni Quarterly, Volume 25, Number 3, Summer of 1985, for information about the faculty of the Physiology Department from its inception until about 1976. Also, there is much information in Paul Clark's History of the Medical School, Chapter 13, which covers up to 1967. Also, there is another source for those interested in the history of the Department of Physiology. A reunion dinner for University of Wisconsin Physiology Department graduates was held in Washington, D.C. in March 1987 at the 100th anniversary meeting of the American Physiological Society. This was organized by one of my PhD students, Jane Thompson Hart, professor of biology at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. I summarized the history of the department from its formation until 1972. This was videotaped by Daniel Savage, another one of my PhD students. I plan to provide a copy of the video to the Oral History Project. Next in the outline are questions relating to the functioning of the department. I shall answer them briefly. I schedule meetings of the faculty of the department whenever items arose which required consideration. This was true whenever an appointment to a position on the faculty was to be made or a policy was to be changed. I was chairman of the department, not the head of it. The regulations of the University of Wisconsin required that a committee of the department be appointed to determine salary increases for its faculty members each year, or in lieu of this, to authorize the chairman to assume this responsibility. During the entire time that I was chairman, this task was delegated to me. Since I was reelected chairman every year for 19 years, apparently I performed the job acceptably. We did not have regular set times for departmental meetings, and there was full agreement that business meetings be held only as specific circumstances arose which required them. One of the duties of each member of the faculty and each graduate student was to attend the departmental seminar, which met weekly, listen to the scientific papers. None of us scheduled any task which conflicted with this seminar, although sporadically other tasks interfered. Cynthia and I entertained the faculty of the department at our home once per year. The executive committee, that is the tenured faculty of the department, met at least once per year to consider hirings, firings, and promotions. During my tenure, there were no firings. We considered promotion of assistant professors or instructors. As chairman, I would raise the question of promoting anyone I believed had a chance to be approved by the medical school's promotions committee. Arrangements were made for a secret ballot on each person being proposed for a promotion. Those who received a majority vote were recommended for promotion by the department. Each recommendation to promote was sent to the promotions committee along with the numbers approving and disapproving. The promotions committee was advisory to the dean of the medical school. As far as I know, no other school in the University of Wisconsin had such a committee interposed between the department and the dean. I am asked to discuss significant controversies that took place during my term as departmental chairman. A controversy, according to Webster, is a lengthy discussion of an important question in which opposing opinions clash. In accord with this definition, there certainly were two controversies. One concerned the entire medical school, and the other concerned mainly the Department of Physiology. The first was what became known as the Bowers controversy. In the last years of Dean Middleton's tenure, President Fred was concerned that Middleton was too conservative about accepting out-of-state money. President Fred called a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Medical School, that is, the departmental chairman, which was held in the president's office. He explained to us that the period of liberal support to the agricultural school was ending, and we were in the middle of a period of liberal support of medical research by the federal government. He concluded that we should be taking advantage of this. He said that he had discussed this with Dean Middleton and found that they were in disagreement about how vigorously the university should seek out-of-state support. Very shortly after this, Middleton resigned as dean and accepted position with the Veterans Administration. Among candidates for dean, Bowers was selected and was favored by President Fred because he felt that, among other things, Bowers would be effective in attracting out-of-state funds. 4 years later, when Dean Bars was presenting arguments to the Board of Regents on why he should not be dismissed, he showed that he had understood well why he was appointed, and also he presented evidence that much progress toward the stated goals had been made. However, specific facts could be cited, if space permitted, to illustrate how his modus operandi had led to conflict. Some rules were changed unwisely and others were ignored. The controversy escalated when Dean Bars chose not to accept the unanimous recommendation of the faculty of the Department of Surgery to make Dr. Anthony Carreri chairman at the time of Dr. Erwin Schmidt's retirement. Failure of the dean to approve the department's choice had happened before only twice, to my knowledge, in the history of the university, and in those cases, what were considered to be valid reasons had been stated. To my knowledge, no official of the university ever presented any reason why Carreri should not have been appointed. The faculty soon became polarized, since most of them either supported Bars or supported the Department of Surgery in the controversy. Finally, a majority of the voting faculty submitted statements to President Elvin asking that Dean Bars be removed from the deanship. Bars could, of course, have remained as professor of medicine, but he elected not to do so when the Board of Regents approved President Elvium's recommendation that Bars be dismissed from the deanship. I have never known what pressures Dean Bars was under from other officials of the university that caused him to refuse to follow the recommendations of the Department of Surgery to appoint Dr. Carreri as chairman. Bars had nothing to gain and much to lose by such a move. Later, Carreri was appointed and effectively served as chairman of the surgery department and then accepted a highly responsible and complex administrative position as president of the Uniformed Services University for Health Sciences. In this position, he successfully presided over the birth of that institution. The other controversy was with Dr. C.N. Woolsey, about the status of the Laboratory of Neurophysiology. Clinton Woolsey had been employed as a professor of neurophysiology directly by the graduate school a few years before I returned to Madison. I asked for clarification of his relation to physiology and found that we were responsible for providing space. He was free to deal directly with the dean of the graduate school and of the medical school. Technically, he was not a member of the staff of the physiology department. Woolsey's objectives, as he discussed them with me in 1952, were to develop the research unit, which was then called Laboratory of Neurophysiology, and to train PhD students and postdoctoral fellows. He had no teaching duties in the medical school and disclaimed any interest in assuming such duties. Other persons were hired who did have appointments in the Department of Physiology and who had their teaching duties there, but were also designated as members of the Laboratory of Neurophysiology. Space for these also was provided by the Department of Physiology. Among this group was Conrad Ockert, who subsequently moved to the Department of Anatomy and then to Zurich as head of their Brain Research Institute. Soon after 1952, Dr. Woolsey raised the question of having the Laboratory of Neurophysiology become a department. We were not convinced of the need or the wisdom of such a change. When the second addition to Service Memorial Institute's building was planned, space in it was provided for the Laboratory of Neurophysiology. Thus, the quarters for neurophysiology became completely separate from those of physiology. As of this time, PhD students working with members of the Laboratory of Neurophysiology were graduate students in physiology. Over a period of about 12 years, I provided the dean's office with the reasons why the administrative setup should continue as it was, and Dr. Woolsey provided his reasons for wanting a Department of Neurophysiology. During Dean Eichmann's tenure, he called a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Medical School to hear the full arguments by Dr. Woolsey and me. Discussion by members of the Executive Committee showed that opinion was divided. No decision for a change was made at that time. However, a short time later, during Dr. Pitot's tenure as acting dean, it was decided to approve establishing a Department of Neurophysiology. Thereby, some of the faculty of the Department of Physiology became members of the faculty of the Department of Neurophysiology. I was elected as a member of the Medical Faculty Advisory Committee, one of the few faculty-elected committees of the medical school. Also, I was elected chairman of this committee. One of the items we considered was criteria for a department. We never got very far because we couldn't list a single requirement that was being met in all existing departments. For example, for this reason, the teaching of medical students could not be listed as a requirement for a medical school department. Here I shall comment about salaries. I think the one reason that the department had been willing to delegate to me the task of distributing salary increases each year was that there was little to distribute. This usually averaged about 5% per person. Dean Middleton never questioned the salary increases that I recommended. But occasionally, to my surprise, President Fred did sometimes suggest a change of plus or minus $100 for a given person. I always wondered how he knew better than I did what these persons were doing. When Elvium became president, I asked him specifically if he was going to use this approach about salary increases. He emphatically said, "No, that is not my idea of going over a budget." Dean Bowers never asked me to change any of my suggestions about salary increases, but on one occasion he asked me if I was trying to get everyone to the same level. It was true that the spread within each rank was small. Phil Cohen was acting dean for a short time after Bowers' exodus in 1959. During his brief tenure, he and President Elvium achieved for the basic science faculty the only sizable raise in salaries that occurred while I was chairman. They arranged that salaries for the next year become salaries for the 9-month academic year. Summer appointments were available also for most who wanted them. This helped to bring the salary scale in line with other medical schools of the Big Ten. The space allocated to the Department of Physiology as of 1935 was on the first and second floors and in the basement of the Service Memorial Institute's building. As of 1952, there had been negligible changes in space allocation to the department. Already in 1952, plans for completing, that is, making a quadrangle of the SMI building, were being made. As it turned out, it was decided that only half of the planned addition to SMI would be completed. The anatomy department was moved over from Science Hall and occupied most of this addition. Physiology gained some space vacated by physiological chemistry on the second floor of SMI. Later, we gained space when the library was moved from the first floor. Then, when the second addition to SMI was completed, we regained the use of space that had been used by the Laboratory of Neurophysiology. The space available to physiology was adequate, but constant vigilance was required to protect it. I have been asked to comment about the medical school deans who were functioning during my tenure at the University of Wisconsin. I had known Middleton since my student days. He became dean in 1935, the same year that I became a graduate student at Wisconsin. On November the 30th, 1951, I sent him a 3-page letter describing what I viewed as needs of the Department of Physiology and a description of changes I would want as chairman. On December the 2nd, he sent me a telegram which said, "Sold. Wisconsin will meet all conditions without reservation." And he followed this with a detailed letter on December 5th. I replied that I would accept the position as described and soon received a unique telegram. There was only one word, delighted. Middleton meticulously honored all of our agreements, but then after 2 years he was no longer dean. Middleton scheduled one formal meeting each year with departmental chairman to go over the budget of the department for the next year. He took no notes. He sent a letter, no doubt dictated immediately after the meeting, confirming very accurately the agreements which had been reached. No further discussion of the budget for the next year was needed. Questions or problems that came up sporadically were handled by correspondence. Dr. John Bars was dean from 1955 to 59. I have already commented on the controversy that developed during his tenure. According to the lists which I have here, Dr. James Crow was acting dean for 7 years from 1960 to 67. I suppose he was only acting because he did not have an MD degree. I did not remember that his tenure was this long, which means that things must have been going rather smoothly. He was successful as an administrator, but this, I think, was not his primary interest. Dr. Peter Eichmann's tenure as dean was, I believe, viewed as efficient and even-handed by most of the medical faculty. I was surprised that it did not continue longer. He may have been more consensus conscious than any of the deans who served from 1935 to 1973. My tenure as chairman ended at about the time Dr. Pito became dean. The administrative setup of a medical school is such that it is possible for a dean to be dictatorial. Most of the committees are appointed by the dean, and the so-called executive committee, which is composed of departmental chairman, actually is advisory to the dean. He can decide what is brought before them and whether to take their recommendations. However, none of the deans under whom I worked had a dictatorial approach. At the beginning of my tenure as chairman, Dr. Fred was president. He was followed by Elvium and then Harrington. As previously described, I had private conferences with President Fred regarding budgets. This was not required by Elvium. I knew President Elvium best since he had been dean of the graduate school and the chairman of the biochemistry department. Many of his graduate students minored in physiology, and I was on many PhD prelims and final examining committees with him. I had several private conferences with Elvium and Harrington. They, as was President Fred, were interested in having the medical school basic science departments take advantage of the rapidly expanding support of research by the National Institutes of Health. Most of the private meetings I had with Harrington as vice president and Elvium as president were concerned with trying to assuage the Bowers controversy. All three of these presidents were able and impressive administrators, although their styles were totally different. Each moved quickly to the heart of a problem. Elvium was more likely to elicit my views of someone by playing devil's advocate. Two persons, Q.R. Murphy and W.E. Stone, were on the Faculty of Physiology when I became chairman and were there throughout the 52 to 76 period. Murphy, one of Dr. Meek's PhD students, was a very able teacher and several times received the award for the outstanding teacher in the basic sciences. Stone, a PhD from Caltech, was best trained in physical chemistry of anyone in the department. I called on him to help with the writing of chapters on respiration and revisions of Best and Taylor's textbook, Physiological Basis of Medical Practice. I was instrumental in the hiring of Richard Wolf, Warren Dennis, and Edward Bitar. Dr. Harry Harlow and I collaborated in bringing Wolf to the university to work jointly in the primate laboratory and in the physiology department. Wolf followed me as chairman of physiology. He retired a few years ago. When Wolf became chairman, I explained that the deadlines for completing paperwork kept getting closer and closer to the time that we received requests for it, and that someday he would be asked to fill out a questionnaire, and the deadline designated would already have passed. One day he came into my office, highly amused, to show me that my prediction had come true. I will continue this report on the B side of the cassette. One time during my stay at Wisconsin, I felt it was necessary to write a letter to the chairman of the Board of Regents. It was being reported in the newspapers that students were going to be told that they would not receive credits for their work at the University of Wisconsin at the end of the semester if they did not obtain one of the identification cards that the regents had decided to require of students. Faculty also were being required to obtain ID cards. Some students and some faculty members were resisting the requirement. Dr. James Nellen was chairman of the Board of Regents. He and I had been fellow students in freshman medical courses in 1935-36, and since he had occupied a desk adjacent to mine in the physiology laboratory, I knew him quite well. I sent a letter to him pointing up the fact that since the rule about ID cards did not exist at the beginning of the semester when the students enrolled, it should not enter retroactively into the question of satisfactory completion of that semester. On the other hand, I believed a rule reasonably could be made that no one could enroll for the next semester without an ID card. Dr. Nellen answered that he was taking the liberty of reading my letter to the Board of Regents and would recommend that this solution be adopted. This was done and no problem was encountered. As far as I know, the fact that a few professors refused to obtain ID cards was ignored. I wrote a letter once to Governor Warren Knowles when I noted that the legislature was considering a bill which would have the net effect of reducing the stipends of teaching assistants. And this was being done at a time when I had already accepted assistants for the next academic year to be paid under the plan that was to be revoked. I received a very satisfactory answer from his administrative assistant, stating that it was unlikely that the legislation would be passed, but if it did, Governor Knowles certainly would veto it. Later, I became personally acquainted with Governor Knowles, and my wife, as president of the University League, became well acquainted with Mrs. Knowles. It has been suggested that I comment on the disruptions of the 60s. The United States was militarily involved in the Vietnam War from 1961 to 1972. There was turmoil on the University of Wisconsin campus during most of this time. It was of a degree almost equal to that at Berkeley. The peak of the unrest was reached in 1967, which I believe is the year when Armstrong blew up the math building, which was just across the street from SMI. Many students wanted the United States to get out of the war, and they chose obscene language and damage to property as the two methods of getting the attention of the establishment. To keep order on the campus was a problem mainly for administrators above the departmental chairman level. Several general faculty meetings were held for the purpose of finding ways to reduce the tension. Two of these I particularly remember. At one of them, a small group of radicals who were a part of the problem tried to take over the meeting. Professor Cleary, who had rewritten Robert's Rules of Order, had been appointed as parliamentarian. He smoothly thwarted all attempts of the radicals to disrupt the meeting. Another memorable meeting was in the Stock Pavilion. To enter, we walked between two lines of students who were saying unpleasant things to us as we passed. For example, one said that we were afraid to be there because we knew that while we were there, someone might be trashing our homes. Inside the building, the balcony was completely occupied by students, some of whom regularly disrupted the meeting by shouting obscenities. There was frequent use of the four-letter F word. In 1967, I was 57. I decided to revise my retirement plan so that I would be able to retire at 66 instead of continuing until 70 as the university allowed. Personally, I never believed that we should have become involved in the Vietnam War. My thinking was influenced by the attitudes of Wayne Morse, since I knew him personally and had sat on committees with him when he was on the faculty of the University of Oregon Law School. I viewed him as an able and judicial person. He viewed the Tonkin Gulf incident as a trumped-up basis for escalating our involvement in the Vietnam War, and it seems that this is now accepted as correct. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution was repealed in 1970. Morse was one of the two people who had voted against the resolution when it was passed in 1964. Incidentally, probably most people don't know that Wayne Morse was born in Madison, Wisconsin. During the 60s, there were various other conflicts not related to the unhappiness with the Vietnam War. There were sit-ins of black students presenting to administrators their non-negotiable demands. Unhappiness had developed also among teaching assistants, who certainly were not viewing their employment in the light that I viewed mine as a research assistant and instructor. Sometime between 1935 and the 1960s, students had developed the view that it was their right to receive a living wage while attending graduate school. There were TA strikes, but none of the TAs in the Department of Physiology participated. I always felt that black students were welcome at the University of Wisconsin. A special effort was made to increase their numbers. I was personally concerned in the search for qualified black graduate students and in obtaining funds for their support. I was major professor for several black graduate students, one of whom received the PhD degree and subsequently received the MD degree from Wisconsin. We had hired him as a teaching assistant throughout his graduate work. I will now comment on attempts to rate physiology departments. Rating of departments has been attempted a few times by the American Council on Education. One of these reports was published in 1966 based on a questionnaire circulated in 1964. They state in the foreword that the publication does not claim to be anything more than a report of opinion. In the case of physiology, they obtained opinions from 117 respondents from 71 departments. 27 respondents were departmental chairmen, 47 were categorized as senior scholars, and 43 as junior scholars. A list of the 71 departments was sent to each evaluator, and he indicated his opinion of quality of the graduate faculty of each department in one of five categories, ranging from distinguished to inadequate. Secondly, he was to rank effectiveness of the doctoral program in one of five categories, ranging from extremely attractive to not attractive. The ACE report repeatedly refers to informed opinion. How do physiologists become informed about departments other than their own? As a member of NIH committees, I made project site visits to a number of departments, but most physiologists have not visited, much less surveyed, more than a few other departments. They do, however, attend national meetings regularly, and they discuss the attributes of their colleagues and their departments. In short, they gossip, and this is the main source of their information about most other departments. The ACE publication is called An Assessment of Quality in Graduate Education. It is misnamed. It is an assessment of opinions of quality. Is there a good correlation between effectiveness and opinions about effectiveness? There is no reason why there should be, in view of how the opinions are derived and the absence of any specific measurements. I will briefly present evidence that there is not good correlation. The University of Wisconsin Physiology Department has an outstanding record, both as to numbers and achievements of PhD graduates, and we were ranked in the attractive category in the ACE opinion report. I noted, however, that we ranked below a certain outstanding Eastern university in which the Department of Physiology had for years had a negligible PhD training program. On the other hand, that school did have a very strong postdoctoral training program, and I have no doubt that this is what influenced the respondents' opinion in their rating of the PhD training program. Physiology at Wisconsin's overall rating in the ACE report was number 17 from the top. These are designated as strong for quality of faculty and attractive as to effectiveness of graduate programs. The ratings are supposed to be of opinions of conditions as of 1964. The respondents who were departmental chairmen rated Wisconsin Physiology at 34th from the top in effectiveness of graduate programs, whereas the Young Scholar Group of respondents rated physiology 9th from the top. Effectiveness is an attribute presumably measurable in a number of ways. Opinions about effectiveness by these two groups were so far apart that one of them had to be wrong. Which of these guesses about the quality of our program was closest to the truth? The accuracy of placing us at 17 would be correct, plus or minus 16. I was always interested in observing how the Capital Times and the Wisconsin State Journal took opposite sides of any debatable question. The Times tended to be liberal and the Journal conservative. If you liked one of these papers, you didn't like the other. In many places, you need to do research to learn the salaries of state employees. In Madison, the salaries were published in the newspapers. One time, one of these papers made a big point of how many of the faculty of the University of Wisconsin were receiving salaries higher than that of the governor. I looked into the current copy of the World Almanac and found that Wisconsin ranked well below the average in the salary which it paid the governor, and I sent a letter to the newspaper calling attention to the fact that their observation about salaries could mean either that the faculty was paid too much or that the governor was not paid enough. Obviously, in view of his pay compared with other governors, the latter was the correct conclusion. This elicited an editorial referring to my conclusion, and in the next legislature, the governor's salary was very considerably increased. No doubt Governors Kohler and Rennebaum didn't worry much about the amount of their salaries. During my tenure at the University of Wisconsin, there was no standard sabbatical leave policy. I was on leave only during the 1961-62 academic year, when I was appointed on a special fellowship from the National Institutes of Health. During 3 months, I visited laboratories in London, Switzerland, Scotland, and Belgium, and then I wrote a monograph on research that had been performed during the preceding 5 years. Dr. Q.R. Murphy served as chairman of physiology during that year. In concluding, I will answer a question that I have been asked frequently. Why did I return to Wisconsin from Oregon? I was greatly influenced by the fact that I was urged to return by Middleton, Meek, Heron, Tatum, Crumpton, and others with whom I would be working closely. My principal professional reason was that I was interested in personally directing PhD candidates in physiology. I was able to do this and found it to be an enjoyable experience. After completing my tenure at Wisconsin in 1976, I left feeling that my reasons for accepting the position there had been valid. On retirement, we moved to Port Angeles, Washington, where we have lived until the present. After an interim of 40 years, I resumed my hobby of playing the tenor banjo, and for several years have played with a banjo band. I play the melody.